Hello there, everybody. My name is Bea Bonner, and you're listening to Community Voices right here on NPR Illinois. And today, I am talking to Peter Wins, Emeritus Professor of Philosophy at the University of Illinois at Springfield. Thank you so much for joining me today.
It's a pleasure.
Well, I am so happy to talk to you. You have a lot of interesting history, and I don't want to waste time giving a long introduction today. So first of all, Peter, we're going to ask you where you're from.
Well, I'm originally from the New York area, and I went to school in upstate New York, or Binghamton, and then the University of Wisconsin for my PhD in Madison.
So what brought you to Springfield?
A job at what was then Sangamon State University in 1976. I had taught for 5 years in Wisconsin and it was time to move on. And so I came down here and this has been home ever since.
All right, let's talk about Sangamon State. What was it like back then? I talked to a lot of people about it. Some people call it the hippie school, but what, in your words, what was it like?
Well, I was here the seventh year that it had was in existence, and it was a strange place in some ways. We had different kinds of titles for the various programs, but there was this emphasis that I think continues now on teaching, and that was very attractive. There was also the freedom to teach courses that you thought would be interesting to students and helpful to them, rather than a rigid structure, a hierarchical structure of directors telling you what to teach.
Yeah, you know, I went to UIS as a student, and I was surprised when I first came here. I was in the Capital Honors program, and we had all of these question courses, and I'm like, what in the world? What are these?
I made up the titles for three of those four.
What? Okay, but which ones? Who am I?
Yeah, who am I? What do you know?
What do you know?
And I didn't do the power one. What was the other one?
How do you know, or what is power? I think.
Yeah, I didn't do what is power. I thought it should be where's the power. But
well, you know, some of those classes were so interesting that they taught me a lot about myself. But I realized a lot of those were kind of related to philosophy, which I know you have a strong background in. So what drew you to that area?
You can follow whatever interests you in philosophy, because you can take a philosophical approach to almost anything. If it's a science, then there's a philosophy of science about the methodology of science. Mm-hmm. And how do we know what we think we know about the universe or about animals or about human psychology or anything else? You can address that as a philosopher. And in my case, I got drawn to what I call practical philosophy, mm-hmm. which is the application of philosophical methods and concepts to practical issues. They could be individual issues, but I concentrate on social issues. So I have taught medical ethics, environmental justice, environmental ethics, moral issues in the law, and constitutional law that involves moral issues.
So what does applying philosophy to those types of issues actually look like in practice?
Well, in practice, you have to know something about the actual issue. You know, you mm-hmm. can't just cogitate in a vacuum without facts. Mm-hmm. So the first thing is to describe what different people think the issue is and what sides they have on that issue, and see what makes sense each side, and try to find out how one side might be able to talk to the other to, if not convince the other, at least better understand why the other differs. And that, in turn, helps people to understand their own views as a contrast to those they disagree with.
Now, do you see that being a problem these days? You know, people people to have opinions.
Oh, yes. It's quite a challenge, all the more now than it was in the 1970s and 80s and so forth.
So in the classroom, how do you encourage, I guess, healthy debate?
Partly with some humor. If I show that I don't take myself too seriously, even though I take the issue seriously, and if I give students the feeling that they are supposed to have opinions, and it doesn't matter if I agree with those opinions, if I find that I have a classroom that's too quiet on some issue, I'll say, well, let's take a vote. And then some people, you know, I say, who thinks this?
Uh-oh.
And who thinks that? And people raise their hand. Not everybody does, because some are too shy. But once they've raised their hand for it, an opinion, then they're doing an internal dialogue, even if they don't say it, of how they would justify that. And some people will actually go ahead and raise their hand and want to justify it. And then somebody else on the other side will want to do the same. And then we get a conversation going.
Well, that's good, because I think a lot of people are scared to voice those opinions or have that healthy debate these days. Do you see us moving forward and maybe having some healthy debate? Can we get back to where it used to be, where we could have, what is it, the minds out at the table sharing?
It's all the more difficult now that we have electronic means of communication. Mm-hmm. It used to be that we talk about somebody being Mr. Walker and Mr. Wheeler. That is, they were polite when they were walking around, but when they were in a car, they were not considerate of others. Mm-hmm. Well, it's the same thing, I think. When there's not a person in the room, you can be less polite and less considerate, as people feel free that way. So what I think we need to do is get people in the same room more often than we do right now.
I agree. I know you have had experiences not only at UIS, but internationally. So
yes.
How does that change your view of philosophy?
Well, it's more, I think, I learned, for example, when I taught in England from 1980 to 1981, that was my first overseas teaching. It was an exchange. They had a whole different perspective on Israel than I had ever heard in the United States up to that point. And I said, oh, well, that's an interesting way to think about it. And then, of course, there are some funny things that come with the English language when you're in an English language country. For example, I'm a vegetarian, and we have baked beans. And to get baked beans that are vegetarian, you have to look for the special label that says vegetarian. Mm-hmm. So I went to a pub, and I liked jacket potatoes. Those are potatoes with baked beans and cheese on top. So I ordered the jacket potatoes, but I said, but are the beans vegetarian? And he looked at me, and he said, they're beans.
But here, that's something different, you know?
Exactly. Of course, I felt like a fool. But anyway.
Well, no, I know exactly what you mean. And do you think that we here in the U.S. could use some additional, I guess, international perspective in our daily lives?
Oh, definitely. I think that one of the important things to do is to try to learn a foreign language. That's helpful. Just the way they have the words they have for the same things don't always have the same connotations as us. And also, we don't realize, I think, how much the other countries are U.S. watchers and we are not other country watchers.
That's true.
And it's because of the power of our country, and not only militarily, but culturally.
Yeah. Now, a foreign language for me is the STEM field, but you teach philosophy to those students. Now, how do you approach that? Because to me, I'm like, well, how do you apply philosophy to the STEM field?
Well, a part of it is the methodology. Mm-hmm. What methods seem to have been successful in the past to lead us to what we believe to be a better understanding of the universe in general and of various parts of it? And we know that there's something to it because we've got technologies based on it. Einstein's theory of relativity is needed in order for us to have satellite communication, because even though those satellites are not going near the speed of light, they're going fast enough so that there is a time difference between what's going on the satellite and what's going on here on Earth. So that's part of it. But another part of it is to recognize the history of science, that how many things people thought were absolutely certain that we now believe are not correct. And that should promote some humility. Often science is taught as, here's what we know, and it's the current what we know. How did we get to know that? Some history of science is really helpful to recognize that there may be something right now that we don't know that is actually going to modify significantly what we think we know.
Yeah. Now I can see why you came up with those question courses. You know, I think as humans, a lot of us do question things, and some of us, you know, I'm a curious person. I always have a question. Well, why? How? What do we know? And maybe I got that from UIS from the question courses, but I feel like you're right. We do have to question why are things the way they are. And when I was in high school, I was taught that people that liked math like having an answer and didn't need to question things. But this kind of just disproves that point.
Yes. Well, even math. When you have alternate geometries now, and we have had for, you know, 150 years, alternate geometries, that basically upset some of the certainties of a previous time. It turns out that, in a way, if the surface is curved, then two parallel lines do meet.
Yeah.
Not only can, but they do. And so the idea is to not be contrarian and just reject what need a reason to deny or reject what you've received, because a lot of work went into that, but sometimes you should.
Yeah, sometimes you do have to question things.
Yes, exactly.
Keeps the world turning. Now, you've also written several books. Perhaps some of the most popular, I would say, have been about environmental ethics and justice. So how do you see the role in philosophy in addressing one of the big topics today, climate change and environmental justice?
Well, I'm glad you asked that. I'm about to write an article on environmental justice. And my book, Environmental Justice, from State University of New York Press, was actually the first book ever with that phrase, environmental justice, anywhere in the title. The reason is when we think about justice, we think about people, how they're interacting with one another, either winners and losers. We often neglect how the way we treat the environment has an impact on other human beings as well as on other species. And our principles of justice about treating people fairly, about putting ourselves in the other person's position, often gets ignored when it's a matter of the environment. So almost every concept of justice can be applied to the relations that people have to one another indirectly through their treatment of the environment.
Yeah, I'm glad you brought this up because lately on social media, Hurricane Katrina has been a really big topic. And so when I read that you wrote this book, I'm like, oh my gosh, that would be, you know, a perfect way to discuss this concept of environmental justice. What do you think about Hurricane Katrina when it comes to this topic?
Well, when it comes to climate change, which is so much involved with Katrina, one of the things that we should realize is that as a nation, we can do things, and as individuals, we can do things. Mm-hmm. When it comes to the nation, you have to look at what public policies people are backing. Policies to avoid future climate change, and policies to adapt to future climate change, and policies to remediate those who have been the victims of, which is the case in Katrina, of climate change. And what we need to think of is the fact that we can all do something besides support the politicians who take those things seriously, but we shouldn't burden ourselves too much as individuals. There's no reason to be a martyr for the cause. Move the ball in the right direction. Make things better because you existed rather than worse, without thinking that you're a bad person if you haven't solved the whole thing, because you can't.
That's true. So in the time we're living in, we're seeing a lot of flooding. We're seeing a lot of hurricanes. We're seeing a lot of just natural disaster. I mean, we even had a derecho a couple of years ago here in Springfield. What do you suggest people do to help themselves and the environment and their neighbors? Because there was a lot of destruction in the last couple of years.
Well, we have services within the city, and we should support those, and we should support the candidates who support those. But we also, you know, if the tree falls on the neighbor's house, you want to get out there and help, even if you're not a professional. I'm not a professional in that field, but I can be helpful. I'm still of sound enough of body to do that. And also, their kitchen may have been ruined, and so you want to help with their food. And so there are a lot of things that you can do. But then also, you can set a good example. We try to set a reasonable example anyway. We have solar panels on the roof. Yeah. We have an electric car. We buy electricity from CWLP, but there's a program according to which if you pay, I think, another dollar per some number of kilowatts, you can get all of that electricity from renewable sources instead of from the coal that is the mainstay of CWLP.
So everybody hear that. You got some ways that you can help and do good. Yeah. Well, that's awesome. Now, we're running out of time here, but I did want to bring up two more books that came out this year, Philosophy of Religion for a STEM Generation and Abortion Rights as the Free Exercise of Religion. Can you talk about these two books real quick?
Sure. Philosophy of Religion for a STEM Generation was originally going to be titled for the general public, An Atheist's Guide to Belief in God. But it didn't sell that way. And it turned out that there was an editor at Wiley Blackwell who was looking for a book because they didn't have one in religion that incorporated science in the ways that we've been speaking about earlier. The abortion rights as religious freedom comes from my teaching constitutional law, which I've done here at UIS and also in New Zealand, where I'm going to teach again next year. And it takes the view of religious freedom that has been established by the Supreme Court starting in 1940, but more rapidly in recent couple of decades, and shows that by that standard, a woman who claims a religious need to have an abortion, perhaps she promised God during a difficult pregnancy that she wouldn't have any more any more children if this one turns out all right, so she's made a pledge to God. According to what the court has said about other matters of religious devotion, that she ought to be able to have an abortion at least early on in pregnancy.
You know what? I think these are great topics to be talking about right now. It's so timely. Now, if people want to purchase these books, can they go on Amazon?
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah, both cases.
Now go on Amazon and get the book. Now, you have been busy. You said you're going to New Zealand next year. Weren't you in New York this summer?
Yes, yes. I actually made 20 presentations in New York.
Oh, my God.
I taught 4 courses. They were Monday through Friday, an hour and a quarter each session, 5 sessions for each of the 4 courses. The Chautauqua Institution in Western New York State is kind of the mother church of the Chautauqua movement. They never copyright the name, so that there are lots of, there are hundreds of Chautauquas in the country at one time. Now there are still dozens, I think, but they're much smaller operations than this one, which has a 9-week season, and it has an orchestra, and it has a Blake, and it has...
It looks beautiful. And,
yes, it is absolutely incredible. And so we try to spend 4 weeks there, and I taught all 4 weeks. They have special studies classes, and so I taught one on the religion book, and I taught one on a theme that they had last year, our greatest challenges that we can do something about, and I taught one on the Supreme Court, 5 controversial Supreme Court decisions. And then I taught one to Rhodes Scholar, what used to be called Elder Hostel, R-O-A-D Scholar, on the theme of that week, which was the global rise of authoritarianism.
Now, Peter, when are you going to rest?
I don't really have a lot of plans for resting. I've taught in New Zealand since I retired here. The only undergraduate students I've taught have been in New Zealand.
Wow.
I taught there in 07 and then in 10 and then in 16. And now I'll go back next year to teach a class, a compressed class, so I can do the whole class in 6 or 8 weeks. And it will be on political philosophies in uncertain times.
Wow, that is very fitting for these days, I would say.
Yeah.
Well, I just want to thank you for coming to share today. I think this has been a very timely conversation. Like I said, people have been bringing up the environment, climate change, Hurricane Katrina, everything that's trending on social media these days. So I've really enjoyed this conversation.
Well, thank you very much. It's a pleasure being here.
If you missed part of today's show, you can listen again tonight at 10 p.m.